Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome. Professor Paul Ehrlich of Stanford University says if our nation's population was 135 million, where it ought to be, we would not need to import a drop of foreign oil. We'll talk with a noted biologist and population expert about this critical issue. And also this time, we'll hear from a research scientist who brought his video camera aboard a Mexican tuna boat.
And what I saw while I was on board the vessel were hundreds of dolphins being drowned under canopies of the net, dolphins being caught in the net and lifted up out of the water with beaks and flippers being broken or ripped right out of their bodies, dolphins being dragged through the heavy hydraulic power block used to pull the net on board and literally crushed alive.
Sam Labuddy of Earth Island Institute, a judge has ordered an import ban on tuna. The story and more this time on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC, made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. Some call it population explosion. Others phrase it more conservatively, calling it simply population growth. Scientists, though, say it's not so much our actual number, but the speed with which our number is increasing that is the problem. Paul Ehrlich is a noted professor of biological sciences and population studies at Stanford University, where I reached him for some fresh analysis of our situation.
If you could give us some figures on population growth, how much and how fast are we expanding in a worldwide population?
Well, it took about a million or more years of humanity to increase our population to 2 billion people. We reached that point about when I was born in 1932. When I wrote the population bomb in 1968, there were 3.5 billion people in the world, and the world population was growing at about 70 million people a year. And at that time, when I and other biologists attempted to alert people to the problems being created by population growth, the Pollyannas all said, don't worry about it, we'll easily be able to take care of, feed, house, educate, and so on, 5 billion or even 10 billion people. Well, now we've run the experiment because 22 years later, we are at 5.3 billion. The world population is now growing at 95 million people a year, roughly. That is the population equivalent every year added to the world of the United Kingdom, Ireland, Iceland, Denmark, Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Belgium. And curiously enough, we're not even taking care of the original 3.5 billion. In other words, only about a million to a million and a half of those people are living lives that that most Americans would be willing to trade for.
And are you concerned by this picture?
I and all of my colleagues are enormously concerned by this picture because in recent years, population growth has been going up faster than food supplies, and the condition of the global environment has been deteriorating continuously, and the life support systems upon which we depend are beginning to degenerate, and this has the scientific community in general very much concerned.
Why do you feel, though, that the topic does not receive greater recognition in the part of the public and educators and politicians?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of taboos. It goes against our genetic grain because the message of evolution is to out-reproduce your buddies, and so there is an evolutionary pressure to have large families. And, of course, there's for a long time been a accompanying social pressure. So that's one reason. Another reason is that in order to do anything about population, you've got to start 40 years before you see any results, and that makes it very unpopular with politicians who can't have a 40-year time span. You're lucky if you can get them to look ahead 6 months. A current example, is that we have been arguing for a very long time that it would be very beneficial to have a smaller population in the United States. No one has ever raised a sensible reason for having more than 135 million people in the United States, which is what we fought the Second World War with. We now have a quarter of a billion, 250 million. We're the fourth largest country in the world, growing like a skyrocket still. If we had stopped at 135, where we were at the end of the Second World War, and suppose we had continued as we have to become more and more energy profligate, that is, to continue to waste energy, drive gas guzzlers per capita as we do now. Even so, with only 135 million people, we wouldn't have to burn one drop of imported oil or 1 ounce of coal in order to support ourselves. So right now, you can easily say that if it weren't for our profligate population growth, we wouldn't be involved with Saddam Hussein.
I want to ask you in a moment what you think ought to be done, but for the immediate, in the immediate picture, what would be the immediate impact of our continued growth and the other side of that, or the continuation of that, what would be some of the longer range developments?
Well, of course, the immediate impact of our growth is simply a continuing deterioration of the standards of living and diets and so on around the world. That's what's going to happen, and it's already happening in places like sub-Saharan Africa. The longer range, and it may not only be a few years longer range, we don't know, involves such things as global warming, to which population growth is an enormous contributor. And there, for instance, we don't know if the severe drought in Europe this year has been related to global warming. We don't know if the 88 drought in the United States and China was related to it. And scientists are simply not sure how soon we will begin to see the catastrophic weather changes that are likely to accompany the warming, and the warming itself is certain. So the longer range effects of population growth are going to be deterioration of everybody's quality of life and a possible collapse of civilization unless we do something about it.
One of the curiosities of the human spirit, human character, is that we don't seem to take action until something is really literally at our front door. We can see tangible evidence that something is or is not a problem or is a threat. What do you think ought to be done about this on a three-tier level, internationally, nationally, in terms of the United States government and our culture, civilization, and what could be done on an individual level?
Well, I think to start at the individual level, we have to train everybody to do what does not come naturally to human beings. In other words, for the millions of years of our evolution, we learned to react to things like cave bears appearing in the door of the cave, or the branch we're standing on cracking, or a flash flood in the ravine in which we happen to be standing, and did not learn either genetically or culturally to deal with things, trends that took place over decades, primarily because there was nothing we could do about them. If the climate started to change on Australopithecus, one of our ancestors, there was nothing. Australopithecus was neither causing the change, nor could it do anything about it. And suddenly, in the last 40 years, all the rules of the game have changed, and we have got to learn to develop what we've called slow reflexes, that is, to learn to react to things like the buildup of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere or the gradual accumulation of nuclear weapons and so on. So the very first thing to do is to start educating people to how to think about these longer-range trends, and that these trends can be equally as threatening as the things we deal with easily, like muggers and threats of war and so on.
Which brings us to the one of the other levels that I mentioned nationally. What could we do from a leadership and government point of view, either on a state or a national federal level?
Well, curiously enough, there was a time when George Bush understood the population problem thoroughly. In fact, if you looked at Anna, my new book, The Population Explosion, we have a wonderful quote in there from him from an introduction he wrote in 1974 to a book by Phyllis Pietro on the population problem. Today, the population problem is no longer a private matter. In a world of nearly 4 billion people increasing by 2% or 80 million more every year, population growth and how to restrain it are public concerns that command the attention of national and international leaders. It is quite clear that one of the major challenges of the 1970s will be to curb the world's fertility. Now, when he wrote that, he was ambassador to the United States in the United Nations. He's talked about nearly 4 billion. Now we're well over 5. He said 80 million more each year. Now there are 95 million more each year. He did nothing to curb fertility in the 70s. And, of course, he's as bad as Ronald Reagan was, presumably because of that jerk Sununu, on this issue today. So Bush knows better. I talked to him about this in the late 60s when he was head of a Republican task force in the House on population and resources. So the first thing you want to do is replace George Bush. I don't care whether you replace him with a good Republican or a good Democrat, but get rid of George Bush and John Sununu and get some leadership from the top on these issues.
And then what about once we establish, as you say, good leadership at the top, how will that be coordinated with good leadership at the top of virtually every other nation in the world?
Well, again, most other nations are well ahead of us on this. In other words, birth rates in Europe are generally much lower than ours. The United States has got the most serious problem and is at the same time the most overpopulated country because, of course, it isn't just the number of people we have, it's what they do. And when you factor in the impact of the average American on the environment, you see right away that we are by far the big destroyers of planetary systems, you know, things that support human beings.
So in the end, are you hopeful that we individually, Americans individually, will see the problem and be able to do something ahead of time, or what do you feel?
I'm very hopeful that first of all, I think with some leadership, we're already, a lot of people understand the problem and are moving in the right direction. And I think with the right leadership, we could move very rapidly, just like Eastern Europe when the time was right, went in the right direction at a rate that none of us thought was possible. Just like birth rates actually dropped in the United States in the early 70s at a rate that people previously didn't think was likely. I mean, social systems can change very fast when you have the right leadership or the right conditions, and what we have to do is find out how to get that leadership in those conditions.
Ehrlich says we ought to measure life by the quality of life of the individual rather than the gross national product, which is a measure of the aggregate, a measure based on the idea that more and bigger is better. Professor Paul Ehrlich at Stanford University, along with his wife, Anne, authored a book this spring, The Population Explosion, published by Simon & Schuster in New York. This is Bruce Robertson. Judge Thelton Henderson, a Carter appointee, has upheld the 1972 Marine Mammal Protection Act, a federal law protecting dolphins, a law that Earth Island Institute had charged the federal government had been violating itself. I spoke with Earth Island Institute Associate Director Brenda Killian, who explains.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act, as it was first written when it was introduced in 1972, basically called for an end to the dolphin slaughter, protects marine mammals, whereas so that you and I, the average person, cannot go up and harm a dolphin. If we did, that's a federal offense. Unfortunately, the tuna industry lobbied very hard to get an amendment added to the Marine Mammal Protection Act so that professional tuna fishers out there, captains of these vessels, all they have to do is pay a $200 fee, license fee, to legally set nets on dolphins, chase dolphins, and legally kill dolphins. And that's what's legally happening right now in the eastern tropical Pacific, and the United States tuna fleet can legally kill 20,500 dolphins a year.
I wanted to ask you specifically, even literally as we speak, in the sense of 1990, this is still going on?
This is still going on. There are fewer and fewer U.S. vessels setting nets on dolphins for a number of reasons. The most exciting reason is that the market for tuna caught on dolphins is dropping with the announcement of the major tuna companies such as Starkist and Chicken of the Sea. The incentive for setting nets on dolphins is dropping. But another reason why so many U.S. vessels are either reflagging to, let's say, a Mexican flag or a Panamanian flag is so that they can get around that dolphin mortality limitation, and also so that they can hire cheaper labor and get around the union payments and that type of thing. A lot of these vessels are also moving out of the eastern tropical Pacific, where the association with yellowfin tuna and dolphins does not occur at all.
And presumably they are doing this because that is the easiest way to net the yellowfin tuna, is to locate the dolphin herds, and it's more expensive to avoid that procedure?
Well, basically, it's not that much more expensive. I think the bottom line here is that human beings by nature are lazy. They've been setting nets on dolphins, using dolphins as beacons to find that yellowfin tuna for almost 30 years. It's the type of thing where it's force of habit. It would take a little bit more effort and a little bit more intelligence, I think, to use that radar and that sonar and those fancy fish scanners. See, these vessels that they use to set nets on dolphins, that they chase the dolphins with, these big purse seiners, some of them cost up to $16 million. They have loads of high-tech equipment on board that they just have not utilized. I mean, they haven't even trained some of their crew members to use this equipment because they've been able to just sight the dolphins and chase the dolphins and net the dolphins. But we are working diligently now that the markets for tuna caught on dolphin are closing. We're working to get the laws passed and enforced. We want dolphin mortality to be at zero for the United States fleet. None of this 20,500 dolphin mortality level. We want it back to zero, and we're not going to stop until it is zero.
And in fact, what is it that you are charging as per this marine protection law, marine mammal protection law? What have you charged? What is the lawsuit?
Well, so far, we first filed this lawsuit in order to get 100% observer coverage on U.S. vessels. The law states, as it was written by our Congress, that the United States tuna fleet should have 100% observer coverage, and the Department of Commerce, National Marine Fisheries Service, fought us on that, basically fought the people of the United States on that and said they did not have enough money, so we had to take them to court, and the judge did agree that, yes, it's the law, they should have 100% observer coverage. They had to call back a couple U.S. vessels and said, you cannot leave port unless you have a federal observer. So we won there. Then we had an extension of the suit, and we filed in order to stop the use of explosives on dolphins. Up until April 1st of this year, the U.S. fleet was legally allowed to throw explosives, i.e. firecrackers, cherry bombs, what are known as seal bombs, down on the dolphins to get them to huddle together. And we had to take them to court to get them to stop doing that. Then we took them to court again in order for the Department of Commerce to enforce the embargo ruling, the embargo laws, which are part of the Marine Mammal Protection Act as well, which were not being properly enforced. It's real apparent and it's real unfortunate that dolphin protection is at the bottom of the Department of Commerce's list. They're more concerned with profits, and we need the people of the country and we need the environmental groups to really to extend a lot more pressure on them to show them that we don't want dolphins wiped out for a tuna fish sandwich. There's too many other threats imposed on them out there in the oceans, and we got to protect them in every way that we can.
And now, could you characterize what Judge Henderson said in his ruling?
Well, it was wonderful. He stated that the dolphins should not suffer while there's all this time going by without the Department of Commerce tabulating and formulating the dolphin mortality levels for the international fleets. And one of his quotes was great. He said, "In this day of computers and calculators, you think that you'd be able to formulate these equations within a matter of hours rather than a matter of months." And he stated that while it is true that the judiciary will generally respect agency policy, it will not do so, as in this instance, where that policy is in clear contravention of a congressional statute. In other words, our Department of Commerce must obey the laws as written by our Congress Department. So he read the laws as clear as they were and agreed with the environmental community that these laws were not being properly enforced.
Brenda Killian, Associate Director of Earth Island Institute in San Francisco. Under terms of the ban, the United States will not accept tuna caught by Mexico, Venezuela, Panama, Ecuador, and the island nation of Vanuatu, until those nations provide proof that they are killing no more than U.S. fishermen are, which, as we have just heard, is still a staggering number. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. Sam Labuddy is a research biologist with the San Francisco-based environmental group Earth Island Institute, and 3 years ago he took his research out on the high seas to find out just what really is happening to the herds of dolphin often found in the vicinity of yellowfin tuna.
Fishing for tuna on dolphin herds is something that's unique to the eastern tropical Pacific, that is the area of ocean off the west coast of Central America and Mexico. And the reason that the tuna fishermen have taken to trapping dolphins intentionally inside these giant mile-long nets called purse seines has to do with the fact that this is the only part of the world's oceans where large yellowfin tuna, what we know as light tuna, can be found schooling up underneath herds of dolphins. And as a means of catching the tuna that shadow the dolphins wherever they go in this part of the ocean, the tuna fishermen have taken to basically corralling the dolphins at sea with the use of speedboats, helicopters, and high concussion explosives, all of which are used to disrupt the dolphin's sonar and terrify them into grouping together into a compact herd, and then setting this giant mile-long net around the dolphin herds, sort of a circular wall of net that extends about 300 to 400 meters below the surface of the water, and then closing the net from the bottom, or pursing it as it's called, by hauling in a steel cable threaded through rings on the bottom of the net, hence the term purse seining. And what I saw while I was on board the vessel were hundreds of dolphins being drowned under canopies of the net, dolphins being caught in the net and lifted up out of the water with beaks and flippers being broken or ripped right out of their bodies, dolphins being dragged through the heavy hydraulic power block used to pull the net on board and literally crushed alive. Basically, you have to... This fishery, it would be barbaric by anyone's standards. It's the type of thing that wouldn't last for 3 days if it took place inside of land where people could actually see it. But because it takes place on the high seas, it's basically out of sight and out of mind.
And you've said it's out of sight, out of mind, but in fact we are speaking to you precisely because to your camera it was not out of sight, out of mind. T- Tell us a bit about the story of how you came to capture these actions, these activities on video.
Well, as it turned out, I was actually working as a federal biologist for the National Marine Fisheries Service, the same government entity that we currently have a lawsuit against for their failure to enforce the Marine Mammal Protection Act. I was up in Alaska on a foreign vessel for several months, sort of a combination scientific technician and resident cop on board a vessel. And after I finished, I was approached and asked if I would be interested in serving as an observer on a tuna boat in San Diego. I declined to take the job for a number of reasons, and it wasn't until a couple months later when I entered the offices of Earth Island Institute in San Francisco that I found out that the job I had been offered was to go out and count dolphins that were legally being hunted down, captured, and killed in the nets of U.S. tuna vessels. And I have to say the least, I was a bit appalled because I'd never heard of this, and outraged because this willful slaughter of tens of thousands of dolphins each year was taking place with the sanction of the U.S. government. Now, it shouldn't come as any surprise to anyone, really, that it's a felony offense for a U.S. citizen to harm, harass, injure, let alone kill a dolphin. You can go to jail for it. And yet the federal government, in its infinite wisdom and generosity, grants permits, slaughter permits, to the multimillionaire owners of tuna boats ported in San Diego that allow them to go out and hunt and kill thousands of dolphins every year if they see fit. Hardly what you'd call parity under the democratic process. And when you view this in the context of so much other mismanagement of what are called natural or public resources in the United States, you see it's very much a part and parcel of our nation's unspoken, unwritten, but very active policy of deficit spending on the environment.
The fishermen did not know you were on board, at least not in that capacity, though, did they?
Oh, no. Well, I sort of got off the track here, but what happened was that when I found out about this, that these dolphins were being killed in U.S. tuna nets, I asked the people at Earth Island, I said, well, why aren't you telling anybody? And they said, well, we're trying, but one of the difficulties we're encountering is that there's no documentation available. And as it turned out, that even though this fishery had been going on nearly 30 years, no one had ever managed to take any pictures of it. They simply don't let cameras on board U.S. tuna vessels, even for federal observers, as I found out when I volunteered to go ahead and take this job for the government and bring back all the documentation they needed. The folks at Earth Island said, well, that's very noble, but the fact is you won't be able to get on a U.S. boat with a camera, even though you're a federal observer. And at that point, it seemed like the only opportunity that existed for documenting exactly what was happening was to go undercover overseas on a foreign vessel where they used precisely the same technology, but at the time didn't have quite as much sensitivity to the issue and the possible repercussions stemming from someone who could document this fishery and take the images back to the American public and policymakers. And so I went down to Mexico, and for about 4.5 months, worked and lived on a tuna boat in and out of port, and filmed the routine capture and slaughter of hundreds and hundreds of dolphins in the course of tuna fishing operations.
How did you manage to keep your camera both handy and actually running while you were supposedly working as a fisherman?
Well, it was difficult. I initially was a deckhand and engineer, and so I had duties that during fishing operations that were ran, you know, contrary to the, you know, my ability to be able to film what was going on. So I managed to secure the cook's job. I became the cook on board the vessel, and that gave me basically absolute liberty to film during fishing operations. And I basically characterized myself in the eyes of the crew as a itinerant fisherman from Alaska, a gringo who was interested in going down to South America and learning Spanish and making some money. And the video camera I passed off as a gift or a toy, if you will, from my wealthy retired father, who wanted to see what his firstborn ne'er-do-well son was doing off in parts of the world he'd never seen. And it worked. It's sort of like writing fiction. You have to establish a contract with your reader to get them to follow you in terms of the rest of your story. So I spent a lot of time filming fishing operations on dolphins with impunity. I also filmed a lot of other activities on the boat just to make it look like I wasn't completely focused or obsessed with dolphin mortality. It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life, to watch these magnificent, intelligent creatures, the only species of wild animal on this planet that thinks that saving human life is important, be routinely hunted down, maimed, and slaughtered simply to maximize profits for some otherwise very wealthy fishermen. And what I had to remember was that what was important was to bring these images back to where the whole problem could be addressed, involving a number of fleets and about 100 vessels internationally, rather than just what was trying to mitigate this, you know, the circumstances that were occurring on a single vessel.
Mr. Labuddy, I wonder what would have happened, do you suppose, had you been found out your true mission?
Well, it's sort of a moot point. I think at the very least my camera and my tapes wouldn't have made it back to port. I don't know if I would have or not. I'm glad that it turned out like it did. We've had some incredible successes in the last 6 months. What would the large U.S. tuna companies like Starkist going dolphin safe? And right now we're very much concerned with trying to effect an end to the willingness of other international markets to accept this tuna coming out of the eastern tropical Pacific that's caught on dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're doing quite well. I think that hopefully with the lawsuit that we have and the great concern that's been manifest by the American public toward resolving this issue, I think by the beginning of 1992, we might actually see the United States become a dolphin-safe nation, in that no tuna caught in either purse seines on dolphins or in drift nets would be allowed to be sold or imported or processed in the United States.
Biologist Sam Labuddy speaking to us from his laboratory at the Earth Island Institute in San Francisco. The dolphins are protected by the 1972 Marine Mammal Protection Act, which, amended in 1988, says that all nations must reduce their dolphin kill to meet the U.S. tuna industry's, quote, incidental take. Though U.S. slaughter has declined by 36%, foreign kills rose by 40%, with 100,000 dolphins being killed per year now. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. And that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed the Environment Show. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, feel free to drop us a line. It's the Environment Show, WAMC, 318 Central Avenue in Albany, New York, and the zip code is 12206. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.